This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Tiger's Daughter, written by K. Arsino Rivera, performed by Caroline McLaughlin. The Empress, Chapter 1. Empress Yui wrestles with her broken zither. She'd rather deal with the tiger again, or the demons, or her uncle. Anything short of going north, anything short of war. But a snap string, one cannot reason with a snap string, nor can one chop it in half and be rid of the problem. When she stops to think on it, chopping things in half is part of why she's alone with the stupid instrument to begin with. Did she not say she'd stop dueling? What was she thinking accepting Ryama Tun's challenge? He's only a boy. And now he will be the boy who dueled one-stroke Shizuka, the boy whose sword she cut in half before he managed to draw it. That story will haunt him for the rest of his life. The Phoenix Empress, daughter of heaven, the light of Hokkaido, celestial flame. No, she is alone. Let her wear her own name. Oh, Shizuka pinches her scarred nose. When was the last day she behaved the way an empress should? Shizuka. Can she truly be Shizuka for an hour? Twists the silk between her first two fingers and threads it through the offending peg. Honestly, the nerve. Sitting in her rooms, taking up her valuable space, taunting her. She can hear her father's voice now. Shizuka, it will only be an hour. Won't you play me something? But Oitsuki, imperial poet, brother to the emperor, heard music wherever he heard words. Scholars say that the Hokkaido language itself was not really born until Oitsuki began to write in it. What use did he have for his daughter's haphazard playing? Shizuka, your mother is so tired and upset. Surely your music will lift her spirits and calm her. But it was never the music that cheered her mother. It was merely seeing Shizuka play, the sight of her daughter doing something other than swinging a sword. Oh, Shizuru did little else with her time, given her position as imperial executioner. Wherever she went, the crows followed in her footsteps. Already 36 by the time she gave birth to her only child, Oh, Shizuru wore her world weariness like a crown. And who can blame her with the things she had done? Ah, but Shizuka hadn't understood back then why her mother was always so exhausted, why she bickered with the emperor whenever she saw him, why it was so important to her that her daughter was more than a duelist, more than a fighter, more like her father and less like... The empress frowns. She runs a string along the length of the zither toward the other peg. Thanks to her modest height, it takes a bit of doing. She manages. She always does. Perhaps she will be a musician yet. She will play the music Honda wrote for View Rolling from Hills, she thinks. The melody is simple enough that she's memorized it already, soothing enough that she can lose herself in its gentle rise and fall. Funny how you can hate a poem until the day you relate to it. Then it becomes your favorite. She strikes the first notes, and that is when the footfalls meet her ears. Footfalls meet her ears, and her frown only grows deeper. No visitors, she said. No treating with courtiers, no inane trade meetings, no audience with the public, nothing. Just her and the zither for an hour. 1 hour. Was that so difficult to understand? She shakes her head. Beneath her breath, she mutters an apology to her father. One of the newer pages scurries to the threshold. He's wearing black and silver robes emblazoned with Daldoan's province's seal. Is this Jiro Tool's latest son? He has so many she can't keep track anymore. Eventually she's going to have to make an effort to remember the servants' names. The new boy prostrates himself. He offers her a package wrapped in dark cloth and tied together with twine. It's so bulky the boy's hands quiver just holding it. Some idiot suitor's latest gift. Only one thing makes a person foolhardy enough to contradict the Empress's will, and that is infatuation. Not love. Love has the decency to send up a note. Not whatever this was. You may speak, she says. Your Imperial Majesty, he says. This package was, we think, addressed to you.
You think?
She crooks a brow. Rise. The boy rises to his knees. She beckons him closer and he scrambles forward, dropping the package in the process. It is a book. It must be. That sort of heavy thwack can only come from a book.
Doan Tun, she says. You are not in trouble, but tell me, why are you bringing me something you can't be certain is mine?
He's close enough now that she can see the wisp of black hair clinging to his upper lip. Good. From a distance, it looked like he'd taken a punch to the face.
Your Imperial Majesty, Most Serene Empress Phoenix.
Your Imperial Majesty suffices in private conversation. He swallows.
Your Imperial Majesty, he says. The handwriting is, if you will forgive my bluntness, atrocious. When I received it, I had a great deal of difficulty deciphering it.
Oh, Shizuka turns toward the zither as the boy speaks. For not the first time in recent years, she considers trimming her nails. But she likes the look of them, likes the glistening dust left behind by the crushed gems she dipped them in each morning.
Continue.
As he speaks, she runs her fingertips along the strings of her zither. If she closes her eyes, she can still hear view from rolling hills.
I sought out the aid of the elder servants, he says. One of them pointed out that this is in the horse script.
Oh, Shizuka stops in mid-motion. No one writes to her in Korin. No Hakaran courtiers bother learning it. Horse lords are beneath them, and thus there is no reason to learn their language. It's the same reason only Shinese lords learn to read and write that language. The same reason Jian is a cipher more than a tongue. The same reason one only ever reads Doanese kings in faded, musty scrolls. The saying goes that to survive is Korin, but the saying can be said of the Hokaran Empire, scavenging parts from the nations it swallows up, swearing that these borrowed clothes have been imperial finery all along. How did that drivel go? Hokaru is mother to unruly young nations, ever watchful, ever present. Shizuka always hated it. So the letter cannot be from a Hokaran. For what Hokaran would deign to debase themselves in such a way? Burkila's calligraphy is serviceable, if not perfect. The servants would have no trouble with anything she sent. Which leaves only one Korin who might write to her in the rough horse tongue.
It's been 8 years, she thinks. 8 years since.
I asked one of your older handmaidens, Keikolau, and she said your old friend Oshiro-san couldn't write Hokaran at all, so I thought...
Son. There are 32 different honorifics in Hokaran, 8 sets of 4. Each set is used only in specific circumstances. Using the wrong one is akin to walking up to someone and spitting into their mouths.
So why was it that, to this day, Shefali remained Oshiro-san?
The boy should know better. Son is for outsiders, and Shefali was...
Give it to me.
Oh, Shizuka snaps. He offers it to her again, and when she takes it, her hands brush against his. That fleeting contact with the Empress is more than any other boy his age could dream of. Naturally, he will tell all the others about it the moment he has a chance. His stories will be a bit more salacious, as he is a young man and she is the Virgin Empress, and they are alone together save the guard standing outside. Oh, Shizuka's hands tremble as she reaches for the paper attached to the package. Yes, she who is known as the Lady of Ink, the finest calligrapher in the Empire. Her hands tremble like an old woman's. The Hokaran calligraphy is closer to a pig's muddy footprints than to anything legible, but the bold Korin characters are unmistakable. For O Shizuka of Hokaro, from Barsalia Shefali Ashar. That name. Nothing could make her smile like this, not even hearing the sister's secret song itself.
Doan Tun, she says, her voice little more than a whisper. Cancel all my appointments for the next 2 days.
What?
He says.
Your Imperial Majesty, the Merchant Prince of Shirshar, arrives tomorrow.
And he can make himself quite comfortable in whichever brothel he chooses until I am prepared to speak to him.
Oh, Shizuka says, "Unless my uncle has finally done me the favor of dying, I am not to be bothered. You are dismissed."
"But your Imperial Majesty..."
"Dismissed," repeats Shizuka, this time sharp as the nails of her right hand. The boy leaves. And she is alone. Alone as she has been for 8 years. Alone with her crown, her zither, her paper, her ink, her imperial bed. Alone.
But as she unwraps the package and uncovers the book underneath, she can hear Shefali's voice in her mind. She can smell her. Horses and sweat, milk and leather. And there, pressed between the first two pages, two pine needles. When her eyes first land on the corn characters in the book, oh, Shizuka's heart begins to sing. The colors of the flowers.
Shizuka, my Shizuka, if Grandmother Sky is good, then this finds you sitting on your throne, eating far too many sweets, and complaining about all the meetings you must attend. My apologies for the awful calligraphy. I know you are shaking your head even as you read this, saying something about my brushstrokes not being decisive enough. I have so many questions for you, and I am certain you have just as many for me. Here in the East, I hear rumors of what you've been up to. Is it true you returned to Shisheki Province and slew a demon general? You must tell me the story, and do not brush off the details, Shizuka. I can almost hear your voice. It really was nothing. The day will come when we share stories over kumac and rice wine. I know it will. But until then, paper and ink are all we have. They are old friends of yours, and have kindly agreed to keep you company in my absence. Do you remember the first time we met, Shizuka? Or has that long faded from your memory? It is my favorite story in all the world to tell. Oh, you know it well. But let me tell it all the same. Let me have my comfort. Without you, I'm in the dark. It has been so long, Shizuka, that I might mistake a candle for the sun. Our births. That is where I should start, though I doubt there exists a soul who has not heard about yours. Hokarans rely on numbers and superstition more than they rely on sense. So when you popped out of your mother's womb on the 8th of Jidao, the whole empire boomed with joy. Your existence alone was cause for celebration. Your uncle, the emperor, had let 14 years go by without producing an heir. And there was the matter of your parents as well. The most well-loved poet of his time, and the national hero who slew a demon general with nothing but her fabled sword and my mother's assistance. Those were your father and mother. When you were born, both were nearing 40. I cannot imagine the elation the empire felt after holding its breath for so long. 14 years without an heir. 14 years spent tiptoeing on eggshells. All it would take was one errant arrow to bring your entire dynasty to its knees. So you saved them. From the first moment of your life, Shizuka, you have been saving people. But you have never been subtle, never been modest, and so you chose the 8th day of Jidao to be born. The 8th day of the 8th month, in the year dedicated to the daughter, the 8th member of the heavenly family. Legend has it, you were born 8 minutes into the last bell as well, though no one can really know for certain. I cannot say it would surprise me. You do not do anything halfway.
But there was another thing about your birth, something we shared.
The moment my mother put you in your mother's hands, two pine needles fell on your forehead, right between your eyes. 1 month later, on the 1st of Kurakai, I was born beneath the eternal sky. Like all corn, I was born with a patch of blue on my bottom. Unlike the others, mine was so pale it was nearly white. I was not screaming, and I did not cry until my mother slapped me. The Sambarjan's present told her that this was a bad sign, that a baby who did not cry at birth would make up for it when she died in agony. I can imagine you shaking your head. It's true, core importants are never pleasant. But my mother scoffed, just as your mother scoffed, and presented me to the Sambarjans for my blessings anyway. Just as the Sambarjans held the bowl of milk above my head, just as the first drops splashed onto my brow, She saw them, two pine needles stuck together between my eyes. There are no pine trees in that part of the steps. When my mother told yours about what had happened, our fates were decided. The pine needles were an omen. We would always be friends, you and I, always together. To celebrate our good fortune, your father wrote a poem on the subject. Don't you find it amusing, Shizuka? Everyone thinks that poem was about your parents, but it was about us the whole time. When we were three, our mothers introduced us. Shizuru and Alshara wrote to each other for months about it. For all your mother's incredible abilities, for all her skills and talents, conceiving was almost impossible for her. Your mother, the youngest of five bamboo mat salespeople, worried you'd grow up lonely. Burkila Alshara wasn't having that. She offered to take you in for a summer on the steps, so that we might share our earliest memories together. But the moment you laid eyes on me, something within you snapped. I cannot know what it was. I have no way of seeing into your thoughts. But I can only imagine the intensity of it. All I know is that the first thing I can remember seeing, the first sign to embed itself like an arrow in the trunk of my mind, is your face contorted with rage. And when I say rage, you must understand the sort of anger I am discussing. Normal children get upset when they lose a toy or when their parents leave the room. They weep. They beat their little fists against the ground. They scream. But it was not so with you. Your lips were drawn back like a cat's, your teeth flashing in the light. Your whole face was taut with fury. Your scream was wordless and dark, sharp as a knife. You moved so fast they could not stop you. A rush of red, yes, the color of your robes. Flickering golden ornaments in your hair, dragons or phoenixes, it matters not. Snarling, you wrapped your hands around my throat. Spittle dripped onto my forehead. When you shook me, my head knocked against the floor. I struggled, but I could not throw you off. You latched on. Whatever hate drove you made you 10 times as vicious as any child has a right to be. In desperation, I tried rolling away from you. On the third roll, we knocked into a brazier. Burning oil spilled out and seared your shoulder. Only that immense pain was enough to distract you. By the time your mother pulled you off of me, I had bruises along my throat, and you had a scar on your shoulder. Oh, Shizuru apologized. Or maybe Oitsuki. I think it must have been both of them. Your mother chided you for what you'd done, while your father swore to Alshara that you'd never done anything like this before. Before that day, before you tried to kill me, no one had ever said no to you. You did not come to stay with us that summer. Soon, Shizuru scheduled your first appointment with your music tutor. The problem in her mind was that you were too much like her. If only you fell in love with poetry like your father, or music or calligraphy, cooking or engineering or the medical arts, even acting, anything, anything but warfare. And as for my mother's reaction? As far as my mother was concerned, Oshizuru's only sin in life was not learning how to speak Korin after all their years as friends. That attitude extended to you as well, though you had not earned it. Oshizuru and Burkila Alshara spent 8 days being tortured together, and years after that rescuing one another. When the Emperor insisted that Oshizuru tour the Empire with an honor guard at her back, your mother scoffed in his face. "Dearest brother-in-law," she said, "I'll run around the border like a show horse if that's what you want me to do, but I'm not taking the whole stable with me. Burkila and I lived, so Burkila and I will travel, and let the mother carry to sleep any idiot who says otherwise, your honored self included." Legend has it that Oshizuru did not wait for an answer or even bow on the way out of the palace. She left for the stables, saddled her horse, and rode out to Oshiro as soon as she could. Thus began our mother's long journey through the Empire, with your father doing his best to try to keep up. So, no, there was nothing your mother could do wrong. And when you stand in so great a shadow as Oshizuru, well, my mother was bound to overlook your failings. But my mother did insist on one thing, taking a clipping of your hair and braiding it into mine. She gave your mother a clipping of my hair and instruction for the same reason. Old Korin tradition, you see. Part of your soul stays in your hair when the wind blows through it. vibrating ours together, she hoped to end our bickering. I cannot say that she was right or wrong, only that as a child, I liked touching your hair. It's so much thicker than mine, Shizuka, and so much glossier. I wish I still had that lock of hair. I treasure all my remnants of you, but to have your hair in a place so far from home. Let me tell you another story, the ending of which you know, but let us take our time arriving there. May you hear this in my voice, not the careful accent of a gossiping courtier. May you hear the story itself, and not the rumors the rest may have whispered to you. When I was 5, my mother took my brother and me back to the steppes. We spent too long in the palace at Oshiru, she said. Our minds sprouted roots. She did not actually say that out loud, of course. My brother spoke for her. In those days, he was the one who read her signing. My mother uses a form of signing employed by deaf koren, passed down from one another through the years. Kenshiro did not spend much time traveling with the clan, due to my father's objections, but my brother has always been too studious for his own good. If he could only see our mother once every 8 years, then he wanted to be able to impress her. Thus, he taught himself to sign. Was my mother impressed? This is a difficult question. As commendable as it was that my brother went to such lengths, he was not Korin. He could never be. When he wore a face so like my father's, when he wore his Hokaran name with such pride. But he was my brother, and I loved him dearly. And when he told me this was going to be the best year of our lives, I believed him. On our first night on the Whistling Silver Steps, I almost froze to death. The temperature there drops faster than... Well, you've been there, Shizuka. You know. It's customary for mothers to rub their children down with urine just to keep them warm. No one sleeps alone. 10 to 15 of us huddled together beneath our white felt gaiters. Even then the nights are frozen. Until I was 8 and returned to Hokkaido, I slept in my brother's bedroll and huddled against him to keep the cold away. On one such night, he spoke to me of our names. Shefali, he said. When you are out here, you are not Oshiro-san. You know that, right? I stared at him. I was 5. That is what 5-year-olds do. He mussed my hair as he spoke again. Well, you know now, he said. Our mother's a Karsa, sort of. That means she's like the emperor, but for Korin people. No throne, I said. She doesn't need one, said Kenshiro. She has her mayor and the respect of her people. Ah, your uncle was a ruler and so was my mother. They must be the same. I did not know much about your family back then. Oh, everyone knew your uncle was the son of heaven, and his will in all things was absolute. And everyone knew your mother and my mother together killed one of the 4 demon generals and lived to tell the tale. But I didn't much care about any of that. It didn't affect me as much as you did, as much as the memory of you did. For you were never far from my mother's mind, and she was always quick to say that the two of us must be like 2 pine needles. Yes, she said pine needles, the woman who lived for plains and open sky. I always thought it strange. And when I learned it was a line of your father's poetry, I thought it stranger. But still, I grew to think of you as... Not the way I thought of Kenshiro. He was my brother. He taught me things and spoke to me and helped me hunt. But you? I do not know how to express it. But when I touched the clipping of your hair braided into mine, I knew we were going to be together again, that we were always going to be together. As moon chases sun, so I would chase you. But during my first journey around the steppes, I learned how different our 2 nations were. Kenshiro was teaching me how to shoot. The day before this, Grandmother Sky blessed us with rain, and I hadn't thought to pack my bow away in its case. The second I tried to draw it back, it came apart in my hands. The string sliced me across the cheek and ear. As I was a child, I broke out crying. Kenshiro did his best to calm me. 2 men who were watching us cackled. Look at that filthy mongrel, called the taller one. He was thin and bow-legged, and he wore a warm wool hat with drooping ear flaps. When he spoke, I caught sight of his teeth. What few he had left were brown. His deal was green and decorated with circles. Two braids hung in front of his right ear flap, with bright beads at the end. I tell you, it's because she was born indoors. Berkeela is a fool for keeping her. My brother was 11 then. For a Koran boy, he was short. For Hokaran, he was tall and gangly, all elbows and knees. He stood in front of me, and I thought he was big as a tree. She was born outside, he said. Everyone knows that, Borchu. And if she wasn't, it wouldn't make her any less Koran. And why should I listen to a boy with roots for feet, said Borchu. If she had a real teacher. Her bow was wet, he said. Of course it broke. It could have happened to you, too. No, boy, said the tall man. I know better, because I was born on the steppes. And I grew beneath the sky without a roof to suffocate me. You and your sister are pale-faced rice-eaters, and that is a plain truth. The shorter one, who was squat and had only one braid, only snorted. I don't know why. Rice-eater is not a piercing insult. Rice-tongue is far worse. And on top of that, they called both Kenshiro and me pale-faced, when only Kenshiro is pale. I'm dark as a bay. Anyone can see that. Borchu, said the shorter one, grabbing his friend's arm. Borchu, you should... I'm not going to stop, said the tall one. Berkeela never should have married that ink-drinker. A good corn man, that is what she needs. One who give her strong sons and stubborn daughters, who don't snap their strings like fat little... All at once Borchu grew quiet. Shock dawned on him, and soon he was the pale-faced one. Someone touched my head. When I turned... My mother had emerged from the gare. A silent snarl curled her lips. She snapped to get Kenshiro's attention, and then her fingers spoke for her, flying into shapes I could not read. My mother says you are to repeat what you just said, Kenshiro translated. His voice shook. He squeezed me a bit tighter, and when he next spoke, he did so in Hokaran. Mother, if you're going to hurt him... She cut him off with more gestures. Her horsewhip hung from her belt, opposite her sword. To a child, both were frightening. Kenshiro made a soft, sad sound. Borchu stammered.
I said that your daughter...
A good corn man? Kenshiro said, reading my mother's signs. I don't see any here. Come forward, Borchu. Then he broke into Hokaran again. Mother, please. She's only 5. What were they talking about? Why was Borchu sweating so much? Why had his friend run away? Why was my brother trembling? Borchu dragged his feet.
Berkeela, he said. I just want them to be strong. If you never let them hear what people think of them, they'll weep at everything. You don't want them to be spoiled, do you?
My mother clapped her hands. One of the guards, a woman with short hair and a scar across her face, with more braids than loose hair, snapped to attention. Bring the felt, Kenshiro translated, and the guard ran to get it. In a minute, no more, she returned. She bound Borchu's hands together with rope and wrapped him in the felt blanket. He kept screaming. The sound, Shizuka. Though it was soon muffled, it reverberated in my ears, my chest. It was getting harder to breathe. Ken, I said. Ken, what's happening?
You should turn away, he replied. You don't have to watch this.
But I couldn't. The sight and sound fixed me in place. My eyes watered, not from sadness, but from fear. My brain rattled in my skull. Shefali, he said, look away. My mother drew her sword. She didn't bother signing any more. No, she walked up to the man in the felt binding and ran him through, just like that. I remember how red spread out from the hilt of her sword, like a flower blossoming. I remember the wet crunches of bones giving way, the slurp as she pulled her sword back. Kenshiro ran his hands through my hair. Shefali, he said, I'm sorry. You shouldn't have... I'm sorry. I wasn't paying attention. I couldn't look away from the bundle of white turning red. I saw something coming out of it, glimmering in the air, swirling like smoke. As I watched, it scattered to the winds. This was unspoken horror. This was water falling from the ground into the sky. This was a river of stone. This was a bird with fur. This was wet fire. I felt deep in my body that I was seeing something I was never meant to see. I pointed out the flickering lights to Kanshiro with a trembling hand. "What's that?" He glanced over, then turned his attention back to me. He stroked my cheeks. "The sky, Shefali," he said. "The endless sky, who sees all." But that wasn't what I saw. I knew the sky. I was born with a patch of it on my lower back, and though the birthmark faded, the memory remained. Grandmother Sky never made me feel like this. I felt like an arrow trembling against a bowstring, like the last drop of dew clinging to a leaf, like a war horn being sounded for the first time. "Ken, Ken," I said, "do you see the sparkles?" And ah, the moment I spoke, I knew something within me had changed. I felt the strangest urge to look north toward the wall of flowers. At the time, I'd heard only the barest stories about it. I knew that it was beautiful, and I knew that it was full of the daughter's magic. How could I have known that the wall was where the Black Bloods went to die? How was I to know? Kanshiro furrowed his brow. "You're just stressed, Shefali," he whispered. "You saw something you shouldn't have. But you'll be all right, I promise." I bit my lip hard. Kanshiro couldn't see it. Maybe he was right. Kanshiro was right about a lot of things. He always knew where the sun was going to rise in the morning, and he knew the names for all the constellations. But that didn't change the awful feeling in my stomach, or the rumbling I now heard in the distance, or the whisper telling me, "Go north." I looked around the camp for an oncoming horde, but I saw none. Yet there was a sound rolling between my ears. There was a clatter of 1,000 horses. It wasn't there, I told myself. It wasn't there. I was safe with my mother and Kanshiro. But for the rest of that day, I couldn't shake the feeling that something awful had happened. Kanshiro told me Tumenbear's stories to pass the time. Tumenbear is something like your ancestor, Minami Shiori. There are hundreds of stories about her. All of them are true, of course, especially the ones that contradict each other. It was 1 week later that I received your first letter. When the messenger first brought it out of his bag, I knew it was yours by sight alone. You sent it sealed in a bright red envelope, emblazoned with golden ink. I snatched it out of his hands in a way that made Kanshiro apologize for my rudeness, and I pressed it to my nose so I could smell you. You might find it strange that I was so excited for a letter from a girl who tried to kill me. The truth is, I never bore you any ill will for what you did. When you first saw me, you were struck with unspeakable rage. But when I saw you, I... Imagine you are a rider, Shizuka, a Korin rider. You've been out in the forests to the north for some time, trying to find something to feed your clanmates. 2 days you've been hunting. Hunger twists your stomach into knots. You can hardly will yourself to move. Behind you, you hear something in the trees. You turn, you fire, and you slow down enough to see your catch. 2 fat marmots speared together by your arrow. Seeing you was like seeing those marmots. I knew everything would be all right, so long as I had you near me. So your letter understandably excited me, and getting to smell it thrilled me even more so. A person's soul is in their scent. For the first time since Borchu died, when I took a breath of your perfumed paper, I felt safe. Until I tried to read the letter, then I only felt frustrated. I stared at the characters and pretended I could read them. I traced them with one finger and imagined what you might say to me. Kanshiro caught me at it. "Is that..." He tried to take the letter from me. Only Grandmother Sky could have pried it away from my grubby little hands. After some coaxing, he convinced me to hold it out so he could read it. His bushy brows rose halfway up his forehead. "Shefali," he said, "is this from the Peacock Princess?" I nodded. He let out a whistle. "You've made an important friend. Can you read this?" When I shook my head, he sat down next to me.
Then it's time for some tutoring. Follow along with my finger.
To be honest, I couldn't follow any of the writing at all. Your calligraphy was so beautiful even then, but I could never make sense of it.
You can read Korn letters, Shizuka. Imagine if every time you blinked, everything changed. Where the letters were, what they looked like.
Imagine if they went from right side up to upside down and backwards. That is what happens to me when I read Hokkarin. I made Kenshiro read it to me so many times that I remember it still.
Oshiro Shefali, my parents are making me write this because they think I need to apologize to you.
I think that's silly.
You know that I am sorry, so why do I have to tell you again?
But my mother wants us to be friends, so I have to write to you.
Big lumpy corn horses don't interest me, and neither does archery. I don't know what we can talk about.
Do you like flowers?
I don't know if they have flowers on the silver steps. Peonies and chrysanthemums are my favorites. Most of the time I can guess what everyone else's favorite is, but whenever I try to think of yours, I can't do it.
If you don't like chrysanthemums, at least, then you're wrong, and I'll have to show you all of mine when I see you next.
I'm going to see you again. You're not getting out of that. My uncle is the son of heaven, you know. I don't really like him, but that means people have to do what I tell them. Respectfully, oh, Shizuka.
After horse riding, reading your letter was my favorite way to spend my time.
Kenshiro had other things to take care of, though. My mother insisted he learn how to wrestle and shoot and ride in the traditional way. The trouble was, I didn't have any friends while my brother was away. While Hokkarins hate me because I am dark and flaxen hair and remind them of a horse, the Korin dislike me because they think I am too pampered. When I was a child, it was worse. My nose didn't help.
I have my mother's round cheeks, which you always seem to have an unending fascination for.
I have her wavy hair, her skin, her height, her bow-leggedness, her large hands, her grass-green eyes. But of all the features on my wide, flat face, my nose stands out. It is narrow, pinched, and begging for a fist to reshape it. My father's stamp on me.
Korin children are not known for being well-behaved. One day I was out riding on a borrowed colt, and when I returned, I found a half-circle of my cousins waiting for me. At their head stood a pudgy 10-year-old, whose face was round as a soup bowl and flecked with freckles.
"You're Bakila's daughter," she said, "the one with the stupid nose."
I frowned and covered my face. I tried to nudge my horse forward, but my cousins did not move.
"Needle Nose," called my cousin. "Come off your horse, Needle Nose. We've got to wrestle."
Wrestling is my least favorite of the three manly arts. Riding? I can and have ridden a horse all day. Archery is more a passion than a chore. But wrestling?
I'm still a lean little thing, Shizuka. My cousins have always been able to throw me clean across the ring.
"What?"
sneered my cousin. She slapped her broad chest, smacked her belly. "Are you afraid?" I touched my horse's shoulder. Horse flesh is always solid and firm and warm.
"No."
"Then you'd better get down off that horse," she said. "Don't make us get you."
I raised a brow. I was on a horse. The entire purpose of riding was to be able to get away from things fast. But maybe I was a bit too cocky about that, seeing as I was surrounded by people who spend their whole lives around horses, who own horses, and, as fate would have it, the colt I was riding belonged to one of my bully cousins. My mother thought I should learn how to handle a stranger's mount as well as I could my own. I thought that was silly, as if I was ever going to ride anything but my gray. Still, she plopped me down on this colt and set me off for the day. My cousin couldn't have been happier. He whistled and pulled out a treat from his deal pocket, and the horse trotted right up to him. Which meant I was now close enough for my half-dozen cousins to pull me off my horse and slam me to the ground. What followed was a beating that I shall not waste any words on. You know how savage children can be. Korn traditions forbid us from shedding one another's blood, but that has never stopped us from beating the tar out of each other. Kicking, punching, hair-pulling, none of these draw blood. So it was. I limped back to the Garen tears. The moment my mother laid eyes on me, she sprang to her feet and wrapped me in an embrace. Through sign language and interpreters, she told me she'd take care of things. It wasn't hard for her to find out who put me in such a state, given how few corn are left. Within 2 hours, my mother corralled half a dozen of my cousins near her gare. Mother paced in front of them, her fingers spoke in sharp, punctuated gestures. "I understand a lot of you beat my daughter," Kenshiro translated. My cousins shifted on the balls of their feet. A boy toward the end of the line cried. I stood behind my mother and sniffled. "You are children," Kenshiro continued. "My sister's children at that. If you were anyone else's brats, I'd have the beatings returned 2 times over. But my sisters have always supported me, even if they have spawned lawless brutes." She came to a stop and pointed to the tallest cousin, the chubby girl who wanted to wrestle me. As she stepped forward, I wrapped my arms around my mother's leg. "Otgar," said Kenshiro. "Zugankar Bayar is the meekest of my sisters. When she was young, she was quiet as Shefali, and half her size. Tell me, would you have pulled her from her horse and beaten her senseless?" Otgar crossed her arms. "Mom doesn't have a stupid nose," she said. What was it with her and noses? Hers was dumb-looking, too. Her whole face was dumb. "Otgar by Sak," said Kenshiro. "You speak Kokaran, don't you?" Otgar nodded. "Who doesn't?" "A lot of children your age don't," Kenshiro said. Ironic, my mother chuckled at her joke, making my brother speak those words. "And you can read it?" "Yes," Otgar said. "My father is a merchant. Aunt Berkila, you know this." My mother nodded. "Very well," she said through Kenshiro. "Since you have such a fascination with my daughter, you are now assigned to be her companion. For your first task, you will help her learn to read and write the rice tongue. She has received a letter from Nasurin's daughter. Start with that." "What?" Otgar and I shouted at once. "She's scrawny and dumb-looking," Otgar protested. "She hates me," I said. But my mother shook her head. "My word is final," Kenshiro spoke. "Get into the gare now, or I will throw you in it." We trudged into the gare all right, but it was some time before either of us spoke to each other. 2 hours in, I decided that even if she was uncouth, if she could read Hokarin, she could help me. So I handed her your letter. She yanked it from me and read it with a frown. "Grandmother's tits," she said with all the grace of a 10-year-old. "It really is Nasurin's daughter. Guess I shouldn't expect any less from a spoiled tree baby like you." "Don't like trees," I said. "Too tall." "Yeah, well, they don't move around either," said Otgar. "And neither do you." She sighed. "Fine. Let's take a look, I guess. Can you write?" I shook my head. "Can you read this?" Again, I shook my head. She tilted her head back and groaned. "I didn't think Berkila hated me this much," she said. "But I guess we've got work to do." I can't remember how long it took us to write back. I knew what I wanted to say to you, of course. Otgard wrote it down for me and walked me through each character 10, 20 times. She'd write them in the soot and ash of the campfire. The trouble came when I tried to write them myself. Invariably, I'd write a different character from the one I was instructed, and it would be flipped or upside down, missing strokes, superfluous strokes. It was a mess, Shizuka. After weeks of trying, I hadn't learned a single one. Otgar was at her wit's end over it. "You speak rice tongue like a native." Pointing out my Hokarin blood upset people, and she was beginning to think of me more as a Korn than a Hokarin. I kept quiet. "It's the writing," she said. She cracked her knuckles. "Needle nose, you don't plan on going back there, do you?" I shook my head. From the way my mother kept talking about things, I'd be spending more time with her on the steps in the future. According to her marriage contract, she was not allowed to style herself Grand Karsa of the Korin, but her children were not bound by such rules. My father wanted Kenshiro to succeed him as Lord of Oshiro. That left me to take up her lost title. I didn't know what any of that meant, except for 2 things. One day I'd be as terrifying as my mother, and the steps were home now. Otgar nodded. She reached for one of the precious few pieces of vellum we had. It was a rough thing, jagged at the edges, that reeked of old skin. She grabbed an old ink block and sat down in front of me.
"Repeat what you wanted to write," she said. "I'll do it for you. If you go back to Hokkara, you'll have the servants to write things down for you anyway."
Then, as if she'd realized what she was saying, she grunted.
"But I'm not a servant," she said. "Don't you ever forget that, Needle Nose. I'm your cousin. I'm helping you because we're family, and because Burkila asked."
"Told." She pursed her lips.
"Asked me to," she finished. "Now let's hear it one more time."
So I spoke, and so Utgard wrote. "Oh, Shizuka, thank you for saying sorry, even though you didn't have to. I've never seen a peony or a chrysanthemum. There aren't many flowers here. Mostly it's grass and wolves, and sometimes marmots. Every now and again, we will see one or two flowers. Of the ones I've seen, I like mountain lilies the most. They grow only on the great mountain Gurkhankalsar. Gurkhankalsar is the closest place there is to the endless sky, so those flowers are very sacred. If you teach me more about flowers, I can teach you how to wrestle. But I'm not very good. My cousin is helping me write to you. Hokkaran is hard. Shefali Al-Sharia. I sent that off and waited every day for your reply. Our messengers all hated me. Whenever I saw one, I'd tug their deal and ask if there was anything for me. We take some pride in our messengers. Before we began acting as couriers, it was almost impossible to get a message from the Empire to Shushar. My mother saw how foolish that was. After she traveled the steps to Unitas, she'd established one messenger's post every 1 week's ride. With the help of the Syrians, she recruited into the clan. Each post was given a unique lockbox that only the messengers could open. Anyone could drop any letters they needed mailed inside the lockboxes. For a higher fee, you could have one of the messengers come personally pick up whatever it was. Everyone used our couriers, Syrians, Ikthians, Shianese, and even your people. Oh, the nobles would never admit to it. And we had to employ rice tongues in the empire itself, but they used us all the same. Which meant they paid us. People seem to think my mother is wealthy because of the plunder from breaking open the wall. In fact, she is wealthy because of the couriers, that and the trading. You'd be surprised how canny a trader Burkila Al-Shara can be. But the fact remains that I pestered our messengers so much that they came to hate visiting us. Every single day I'd ask for news. For months, there wasn't any. But one day there was. Another bright red envelope dipped in priceless perfume. Once I read it, it joined its siblings in my bedroll so that I could smell it as I went to sleep. "Al-Sharia Shefali, your calligraphy is terrible. Father says I shouldn't be mad at you, because it is very strange that I can write as well as I do. I'm mad at you anyway. You are going to kill Blackbloods with me someday. You should have better handwriting. Don't worry, I'll teach you. If I write you a new letter every day, and you reply to all of them, then you'll be better in no time. Where are you now? Mother says you're traveling. Koran do that a lot. I don't understand it. Why take a tent with you, when you have a warm bed at home? Do you have a bed? Do you have a room? Or do you have to stay in your mother's tent? Do you have your own big lumpy horse already? My father says I can't have a proper one until I can take care of it, which is silly, because I am the imperial niece, and there will always be someone to take care of my horse for me. Maybe you can do it. Mostly, I just want to go into the imperial forest. Father says there are tigers. My tutors tell me that I should be afraid of you and your mother. They say that Burkila Ashara blew a hole in the wall of stone and burned down Oshiro, and it took years before it was back to normal. They tell me that if your mother hadn't married your father, that we'd all be dead. I don't want us all to be dead, but if your mother could talk to my uncle. He keeps arguing with my father and making everyone upset. Do you think your mother could scare him? Are you afraid of your mother? I'm not afraid of mine, and people keep whispering about how dangerous she is. No one tells me not to talk to my mother, but everyone tells me not to talk to you. I think it's because you're Koran. My tutors won't tell me why they don't like Koran, but I've heard the way they talk about your people. I'm 5 years old. I'm not stupid. They don't like Shinese people either, but they'll wear Shini's clothes and play Shini's music all the time. It doesn't matter. I like you in spite of your awful handwriting, so they have to like you too. I hope you're doing well. Oh, Shizuka. So began our correspondence. You'd write to me, Utgard would read the letter out loud, and I'd say what I wanted them to write in return. I'll have you know Utgard was indignant when you insulted her calligraphy. She was a 10-year-old, and she was trying hard. Not everyone is born with a brush and sword in hand, Shizuka. There are scholars who write little better than Utgard did at the time. She's improved. You'll be happy to know that, I think. The last time I had her write to you was when we were 13, and you commented on the marked improvement. She pretended not to take it to heart, but she made a copy of that letter before giving me the original. Through the letters, our friendship grew. You wrote to me of your endless lessons, of your mother's insistence that you take up the zither despite your hatred of it. You tell me about the courtiers you met over the course of your day. Soon the letters grew several pages long. When I was 7, my mother announced we'd be returning to Oshiro for the summer. I told you all about it. "We will be sure to meet you at the gates," you wrote. "I will have a surprise for you. Do not be late." I cannot tell you how much that simple statement vexed me. A surprise from me, from the Emperor's niece. Kinshiro said it must be a pretty set of robes, something you'd like that I would hate. Utgard said it would be something foolish like a mountain of rice. I remember when I came riding back to Oshiro. I didn't see you at the gates as you promised. Rage filled my young heart, doubt run it dry. What if we were late? I'd pestered my mother into moving faster than she'd planned, and I was riding ahead of the caravan by a few hours. What if that wasn't enough? I took my first steps up the stairs into my father's palace. Servants greeted me with bows and hushed whispers of "Oshiro, sir, welcome home." My bare feet touched the floors. And that was when I saw it, the first peak peony laid out with utmost care at the threshold. I picked it up. It smelled just like your letters. I smiled so hard it hurt my face and looked around. Yes, there was another and another. I ran along the trail of flowers as fast as I could. Soon I was standing before our gardens, where I came to an abrupt stop. For there you were, standing in the doorway in your shining golden robes, your hair as dark as night, your ornaments like stars. There you were, smiling like dawn itself. Behind you were hundreds of flowers, more than I'd ever seen in my entire life, in colors I could not name. There was the angry red of our first meeting, next to the deep scarlet of our last. There was the day's first yellow, swaying in the wind next to a gloaming violet. But it is you I remember most, Shizuka. Your face, your happiness upon seeing me, and all the flowers somehow staring right at you, as if you were teaching them how to be so bright and cheerful. "There you are," you said. "How do you like your flowers?" To this day I do not know how you got them all to Oshiro. Whoever heard of transporting an entire imperial garden? Who would believe me if I told them? The future Empress of Hokkaido and all her children, doing such a thing to impress a Korin girl? Oh, the servants believe it, and I'm sure they're talking about it to this day. It's just like you, I think, to casually do the impossible. The Empress. Chapter 2. Flowers. Yes, Empress Yui. No, that was not the name she chose for herself, and it was not the name Shefali called her. Yui. A single character meant to shame her. Solitude. Her greatest friend, as her uncle saw things. But he was wrong. Besides Shefali and Baljai, Shizuka's greatest friends have always been the flowers. All her life they have been at her side. One glance outside will show her the imperial gardens, where she spent so much of her youth. If she leans back, she can see them swaying in the breeze outside, like the dancers her father so treasured. It was her father who took her to the gardens. He'd always had a fondness for them. When she imagines his face, she sees a dogwood tree in the background and a sprig of the blooms tucked behind his ear. He is smiling in the midday sun, humming a tune he is too shy to share with anyone else. "My little tigress," he'd say, helping her up onto the branches of a cherry blossom tree. He'd touch her on the nose, then pick the brightest flowers for her. Soon they wore matching adornments. "The daughter is the finest poet in the land," he said. "And see how her flowers always turn to greet you. She must have excellent taste, for you have always been my favorite poem." How many times has she clung to that phrase? Is it still true? She shakes her head. Ovitski is long gone, she tells herself. Only his poetry remains, dropping from the lips of amorous scholars, lending bravery to the timid. Only his poetry and his brother. Thinking of her uncle makes the Empress wince. Yoshimoto is nothing like his late brother. He does not even have the common decency to share a resemblance. Where Itsuki was tall and thin, Yoshimoto had always been short and stout. Where Itsuki's cheeks were smooth, Yoshimoto wore a thick beard to hide his youth. Itsuki was a wild maple tree. Yoshimoto was. Shizuka had never been fond of potted plants. She receives them more than any other gift, but no, she has never liked them. She leans toward the window, lost in thought, lost in memory. Her eyes dance over poppies and jasmine, irises and hibiscus, champa and magnolia. And yes, if she looks, she can see golden daffodil. Her mother hated that daffodil, so did her uncle. It stands alone at least 2 horse lengths from the nearest bush, from the nearest tree. The grass around it is, for the most part, untouched. No one dares venture near it. Shizuka didn't even know of the daffodil's existence until one of her walks in the garden. She was 5 at the time, she thinks, or perhaps 6, before she uprooted the gardens for Shefali's sake, but after they'd first met. Her cousin Daishi Akiko came to visit from Fuyutsuki province for the summer. Daishi was so far removed from the bloodline that her children would no longer count as imperial. But she was the closest thing to a friend Shizuka had. Well, besides Shefali, but then she has always been an exception. Daishi was only 2 years older than she, but full of an 8-year-old's audacity. And while their parents were off at court, Daishi convinced her to raid the gardens. Raid. That was the word she used. They were going to the corpse blossom, she said, and they were going to steal one of its massive petals. Then they'd sneak into the throne room at night to hide it beneath the dragon throne. Imagine Yoshimoto's face. Imagine Ohane's. But the moment they stepped in the garden, with the sun hanging overhead, Shizuka knew something was different. As the 2 girls strolled past a rose bush, Daishi suddenly stopped and covered her mouth. "Did you see that?" she asked. Shizuka, 6, pouted and crossed her arms. "Those are roses," she said, "not corpse flowers." "Walk by them again," said Daishi. Grumbling, Shizuka did so. And that was when the shock on Dashi's face turned to awe. She pointed with her rough little hands. "They're turning toward you." Shizuka rolled her eyes. "Of course they are," she said. "I'm the heir." Daishi would have slapped her if she could have, but they both knew she couldn't. That only made Shizuka more bold. "If I tell them to change colors, then they have to do that too," she boasted, and as she spoke, she reached for a pink one. But then, ah, it was as if the rose fell into a bowl of golden ink, for the color spread through its petals before their eyes. Daishi fell backwards, gasping, her hair flying out of its neat bun. Shizuka stood staring at the gilt leaves. She reached out to touch them again, only to find that they were as soft as any other roses. Yet, when the light hit them, they shone like her aunt's hair ornaments. "What did you do?" Daishi said. "How did you..." "That isn't something people can just do." And though Shizuka's heart was a hummingbird, though her mouth was dry and her fingers trembled, she could not let herself be afraid. "Don't doubt me, Akilon," she said. Daishi wiped her nose and frowned. After getting to her feet, she too touched the flower. Shizuka yanked it out of her hand. "It's mine," she said, and tucked it behind her ear as her father did. Daishi could hardly argue the point. But she did smile. "You've got to make me one too," she said. And so Shizuka did. By the start of the 7th bell, when court finished, Shizuka had changed half the eastern garden. Oh, Shizuru found them laughing, rolling along a patch of golden grass. But Oh Shizuru did not laugh, not at all.